Jetzt wird toll, was noch.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Thank you all for coming. Welcome to God and here in the West. My name is Jared. I'll be hosting tonight. Just a reminder, we've got tea and coffee over there for you in the corner. And you're welcome to go out whenever you like to grab a drink or more food and bring it back into the room. More than welcome. God and Beer is an initiative of the Knights of the Southern Cross, and its aim is to bring people together of all ages from all across the suburbs of Melbourne. And the aim is to inspire and strengthen Christians by providing ideas of inspiration, by renewing the church, by drawing on the truth, beauty and goodness of the Catholic faith. First of all, I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Catholic Development Fund. The CDF supports the mission of the church by helping to build Christ-centered, redemptive and transformative communities. It does this by pooling the savings of Catholic community to fund the construction of schools, parishes, hospitals, aged care and social service facilities. We'll have questions at the end of the talk, so please, if you want, write them down or just remember them and go to that at the end. And before I give an introduction to our guest speaker, I'd like to ask Father John to come up and lead us in a prayer. Thank you.
So, let us pray in the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Loving God, we thank you for everyone who has come to this gathering this evening. Thank you that you know each one of us by name. Thank you for your presence with us this evening. We pray that you give John Henry great inspiration as he shares with us what you have placed in his heart. We pray that you, Lord, would fill him with courage and give him your peace. And we ask this through Christ our Lord.
Amen.
Thank you, Father John. So as I mentioned, our guest speaker is John Henry. John has a Medal of Honour of the Order of Australia for his contribution in education and cricket, which spanned over 50 years. That's the education part. He's had a long and successful, distinguished career in cricket, which spans 30 years. He's taught at various institutions, most notably Geelong Grammar, where he was instrumental in the school's development of positive education and founded the school's relationship reparation program. He has introduced relationship-based education to over 110 Australian schools and internationally. He also lectures at many universities, including Melbourne and Hong Kong, to name a few. He founded and is a life member of the Career Development Association of Australia, and joint founder of Positive Education, introducing positive psychology into Australia. He is also a joint founding member of the Flow Centre and has presented overseas at world symposiums on harassment and bullying. He has worked with various organisations, including Parents Victoria, European Commission of Independent Schools, and Resilient Youth Australia. He has also been involved in culture change consultancy for schools, businesses, religious organisations and sporting clubs. He's worked with the state and federal government, multicultural commissions and multi-faith organisations on social cohesion. Additionally, he has conducted forgiveness retreats and is working to introduce a religion and worldview course in state schools in Victoria and nationally. So I'd like to welcome our guest speaker, John Henry.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be turned off within the next 5 minutes.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. Look, it's an honour to be here, and I thank Peter for being brave enough to ask me and then be silly enough to accept it. I'm an Anglican. I was raised in Echuca, and I tell stories. So I want to give you a little bit of background about myself. and then I want to launch into what I think is particularly important. I'm a Christian. I believe in God. I think we're lucky if we do. All the research tells us that we who have faith lead a better life. We make greater contributions. There's no question of that. No question. I was raised in Echuca. My father was a draftsman, and during the war he designed aircraft at Fisherman's Bend in Melbourne. And then the government decided that they would relocate things so that if we were invaded, they couldn't all get one thing at a time. So a munitions factory was opened in Bendigo, and he went there as a 20-year-old to be in charge of the drawing office, whatever that meant. And they were designing barrels for battleships and so on. And he met my mother there. She was 11 years older than me. She was from a property, and her parents had moved into Bendigo and taken her there. They were married in Bendigo, moved to Echuca, where a ball bearing factory was opened, and I was born in Echuca. I have a twin brother, so he's my age, and he lives in Bacchus Marsh. He was wise. He retired at the age of 53, and he was an engineer. I didn't want to be an engineer. My father, in the end, became a production engineer. I didn't want to do that, so I went into education. The reason I went into education really was that at Echuca High School, in those days, this is in the 60s, so it's a long time ago, you applied for scholarships because university was not free then, and I got a scholarship from the Commonwealth Government and a scholarship from the Education Department in Victoria. I took that because it paid more. And I stammered very badly as a child. Has anyone here got a speech impediment? No, you're incredibly lucky. Every word that I've said, I've practiced 1,000 times. And I will stammer tonight, so just be kind to me. When I started teaching, my last year of my university course, I had to pass an allocution test. There was absolutely no way I could have passed that test. And the closer we got to the front, there were all the students that were doing dip ed. We all had to sit in a hall. There were about 600 of us in those days. And slowly but surely, you had to go up on stage and read a passage that you'd not seen before, so unseen prose. And the closer we got there, my friends were becoming more and more anxious because there's no way I could do it. I walked to the lectern as I am tonight. I looked at it and I sang it in plain song. I just sang it on one note. When you sing, you don't stammer. The real problem was that the people thought that I was taking the mickey out of them. They thought I was having a bit of fun. There was white noise, and there's white noise at the moment. There was white noise, so everyone thought it was a bit silly, and they were just chatting and chatting and chatting. And as soon as I started to sing, the white noise stopped. When I finished, they all applauded. They believed I was taking the mickey out. I was not doing that. So the three examiners, two women and a gentleman, Mr. Hendry, room 204, 120. So I went there at 120, opened the door, come on in. They thought I was just a smart aleck trying to rip them apart. And I said, I am... Two letters that trapped me were S and N. When you say S, you squeeze air at the top of your tongue and the roof of your mouth, tongue wouldn't move. I couldn't say. So I will probably trip on that tonight. Forgive me. The second was N. And at the age of 6, I was asked to recite by an educational psychologist. They no longer do this, which is a good thing. I was asked to recite the months of the year, and I left two out. And all of you will know that it was September and November I left out. This leads me into what I'm going to talk about tonight. When mean, the psychologist said to the principal of the school, he's probably worth educating, but he doesn't know the months of the year. I know that she said that to him because the principal of the school, Ichigari State School, there are only 35 students there, and 7 of us were Caucasian, the rest were indigenous from the Kamaraganja Station, mission, sorry. My father was there, and Mr. Railton, Bren Railton, told my father that he didn't know the months of the year, and my father said, what did you say to her? And he said, oh, he would have left out November or September. Now, why is that the case? Life is nothing else but relationships. We're in a relationship now. If this is a quality relationship, you'll listen to me. If it's a quality relationship, you have with Father John, you will listen to the prayer. If it's not, you won't. It's that simple. Life is built on relationships. Everyone here has a matrix of relationships. You're now in mine. You stay forever. Relationships don't go away. They change in nature and they change slightly, but they don't go away. So I've looked really closely when I was learning to speak. I had to travel by train from Echuca to Melbourne 20 times a year from the age of 6 to 13. And I had to do it alone because my father was working, my mother had other children. So, thank God for conductors. So, you used to catch the train at 6 o'clock, eat sugar in the morning, get back at 10 o'clock at night. Had to go by train to Tulamba, change trains, so the conductor had to put me on another train that came through from Albury and then went to Spencer Street, which is now Southern Cross. Then the conductor took me from there across to a tram, gave me to the conductor there, who went up Collins Street past the Federal Hotel. None of you will remember that. The Federal Hotel was green, I can remember that as a kid. And then that conductor put me on another tram and I went up to Melbourne University to the Kathleen Syme School, which is now a library. I had a speech there. She was very old. 30. I was 6 years old. And she taught me two things. She taught me to meditate and to sing. I won't sing for you tonight, but I will ask you, how many of you people meditate regularly? Put your hands up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How many of you pray? Put your hands up. You all meditate. This is really, really important stuff. So what is the concept of meditation? It is to focus your attention. That's all it is. It's to focus your attention. If you can pay attention, you can deal with an issue. If you pay attention, you can learn. This is really critical stuff. We don't do enough of it. When I started teaching, by the way, just to continue that little tale about me and stammering, after I tried to apologize for not doing the right thing, and they were all embarrassed then, the best question asked of me is, how can you teach? I had completed teaching rounds and got really high grades for them. So I couldn't do a lot of damage. I was sent to Donald High School. But Donald High School was in the Mallee. There were 9 members of staff. When I went to teach from Donald High School, I went to Melbourne High School. I had more in my faculty than was the total staff at Donald High School. Then I went from there to Mordale at Chelsea High School, to Monash University, and then seduced to go to Geelong Grammar School to change the culture. Went for 5 years and stayed for 36. It's a long time. That's where I met Peter, wonderful man. Yeah. Our lives are built around relationships. So I want to go through and look at what is a quality relationship and how does it apply? How does it apply to you as Christians? It's really, really important that we think about this and that we live it. So I looked at all the things that allow people to actually perform at their best, to really make a contribution. So what allows Father John to make the contribution he does? You do. It's the relationship that is formed. So I wanted to know what allowed someone to perform at their best. And we talked about basketball. What allows you to be at your best? What allows you to be at your best in a real estate sense? What allows everyone, irrespective of what they're doing, to be at their best? What predicts it? They have to have a sense of worth. Where does it come from? It's all relational. To learn, it's a personal relationship. Circumstance. If you teach, and I did for over 50 years and continue to do it, if I don't have a relationship with you, you will not pay attention and you will not learn. I'm wasting my time. And you're wasting yours. So when there's a sermon, if you're not paying attention, all the work that's gone into it will never get to you. And that's a shame. It's a tragedy. What obligations do you have in a relationship? So I looked at all the relationship studies that have ever been done, and I mean all of them. I looked to see what sort of research has been done. And about 95% of the research that's been done is pretty superficial. It's not that good. But 5% is pretty good. And the best research that I could find was from Tim Cameron at Michigan University. And he was looking at what is really important in a relationship. There are five elements to a quality relationship, and I'll put some handouts on your table. The five relationships, and I would like you, if you could think, please, think about your most, your closest relationship, your most intimate relationship. And this applies to the children in particular. Think about I've been married for just under 50 years. I love my wife dearly. I trust her judgment and on everything. Does she get it right all the time? No. Do I get it right all the time? Of course, she's the luckiest person in the world. It's absolute nonsense. We all make mistakes. I trust her. So what does trust mean in your most intimate relationship? The best definition I've had of trust, came from a six-year-old at St. Peter's College in Adelaide. And the little fellow was sitting at the front waving his hand in the air, and I thought, oh, what is it? He said, you feel safe. It's unbelievably important. And this is neurologically critically important. As soon as you are safe, the reptilian brain, your brain stems, let you go. It lets emotion come in and allows you to think. Up until then, when people are frightened, the reptilian brain takes over and you either fight, or you freeze. You don't think. As soon as you get really angry, the same thing happens. This is really important stuff. I cut someone off in the traffic tonight. I didn't mean to. I made an error. I pressed the button, the window went down, and I waved, and the person flashed the lights, and there was no road rage. Now, if I had not apologized, this all moves to the second most important element of a quality relationship, is forgiveness. Now, all of you forgive. You wouldn't be sitting here if you did not. And the easiest way I can explain forgiveness is to say, look at the word forgive. It's made up of two words, for and give. Take the for off the front and put it at the back. Forgiveness. Give for. The sign. Give for the service. Give for the person driving the car. You cannot learn because you will all make mistakes, and I could ask you to put your hand up if you've never made a mistake. Or with no hand, go up. The only way you learn is to give yourself a break when you get it wrong. Now, all of you will have a ritual you'll put yourself through when you make a mistake. Do you whip yourself? Punch a hole in the wall? I had a student actually do that. Do you kick the dog? Do you go for a walk? Do you count to 10? Every one of us has a ritual. But what really is forgiveness? Forgiveness is the enabling element. It enables you to actually deal with life issues. It's the primary request of the New Testament. Forgive them for they don't know what they do. Desmond Tutu. This is his definition of forgiveness. It's on the back of my card. Forgiveness gives us the capacity to make a new start. And forgiveness is the grace by which you enable the other person to get up, and to get up with dignity, to begin anew. In an act of forgiveness, we are declaring our faith in the future of a relationship and in the capacity of the wrongdoer to change. I sit in the passenger seat when my wife's driving and I don't drive the car. I would have given way to that person. We have to be really careful how we manage our relationships. So forgiveness simply means that you give for, and this is, I'm quoting here my own writing here, the give for the relationships, it allows it to grow. When we trust, when trust is tested, forgiveness enables trust to be regained with respect and dignity. It re-establishes trust when it is threatened. Giving for others and ourselves enables growth. Please give yourself a break when you make a mistake. I found I had to learn that because it drove me mad not being able to say sorry. And the more it made me anxious, the less I was able to do it. That's what forgiveness enables. It opens opportunity. It's unbelievably important. The third element is integrity. And integrity is the intention to do the right thing. Intentionality is really every time Father John produces a sermon, his intention is honourable. Every time I taught a lesson, every student I taught understood that I really worked hard to make certain it was the best I could do. I had Jared in my boarding house. Every kid in my boarding house knew that I would really want the best for them and that I would do my utmost to make certain that occurred. So the intention to do the right thing is what integrity is really about. And I base it on two philosophical underpinnings. The first one is the Hippocratic Oath. So I ask you, would you put your hand up if you have a license to harm anyone? That's the clear message. That's the clear message that came from Christ. You think of all the stories that are told accurately or not so accurately in the New Testament about his preaching.
These are really important, really important stuff. So, first, do no harm. The second is the golden rule. Treat others as you would want to be treated. Now, how do I know about forgiveness? I want to tell you a little bit about my life so that you understand why I'm doing this sort of thing at the age that my wife tells me I shouldn't be doing. I was precociously able, I was this size when I was 13, so I was going to be the next rugby for Carlton, and I'd been signed by Carlton. At 17, Carlton came up and played the Bendigo League, and I played in the Bendigo League as a 17-year-old. And they'd signed me up, and I was going to go to University High School, and by then I'd played two seasons of cricket with the Carlton First 11 and used to, like, it's silly, but they paid a taxi for me to go to Melbourne. So, like just nonsense. Really, I think back on this is mad. And in a small country town, every newspaper item was about how good you were and who you were supporting and you're marvellous. And when you're an adolescent, you do think you're pretty good anyway. On my 17th birthday, Carlton come up to play the Bendigo League in Echuca. And I delivered papers in the morning, got a bit of pocket money, and then rode my bike down. And there were more people watching the ground and watching the game that lived in the town. They'd come from everywhere. And I'd done, the game was going pretty well, and I was doing quite well. And at three-quarter time, in those days, the crowd just come onto the field. They'd put a tarpaulin down, and if you'd been belted in the head, you sniffed a bit of salt, so you got back online, and so forth. It was rather amusing. And my younger brother, Donald, who was 12 and a half, he was in the crowd, and you know I was a superstar, so I didn't want to see him. But he came across and he said, "John, you're doing really well." That's the last time I saw him alive. He was riding his bike home, and he was hit by a truck and died that night. We were sitting at our little kitchen table with our birthday cake with 17 candles on it, waiting for Donald to get home. He didn't come home. The next door neighbour knocked on the door. I went to the in a small country town, when someone knocks on the door after 6 o'clock, there's been some problem. I went to the door. Mrs. Stack, our next door neighbour, lovely person, she said, "Is Don home?" And my mother yelled out, "No, why? What? What's wrong?" There's been an accident on the highway. And Don had been at a scout little get together. He was riding his bike along. He was hit by a, in those days it was a big four-wheel drive truck. We got in our little 1952 Consul and drove up there. My father wisely stopped about 200 yards in those days from where the accident was. And there was an ambulance and a police car, and I got out and ran, and I had held the record for 100 yards for quite a while in northern Victoria, so I was pretty quick, and about 40 yards from where the accident scene was, I tripped over his bike. That particular night, my parents had to switch off the life support. The next morning, it's a small country town. So Sunday morning, family had come from all over Victoria and so forth. There were sponge cakes everywhere, and everyone was pretty quiet. They were all in the kitchen, a very small home, wouldn't have been anywhere near as big as this room. They were all in the kitchen, and there was a knock at the door. I went to the door, and there was the driver. It was Barry. Now, Barry worked for my father. He was a wonderful fellow. His son was in the same class at med school. He just had one too many drinks. These are really terrible things. He said, "Is Jack there?" My father's name. I said, I'll get him. By this stage, everyone knew who was on the front bandit. It was quiet. I went down to the wood heap. My father was cutting and crying. I said, "Dad, Barry's at the door. I'll be there in a second, John." So he composed himself and came up, walked through the kitchen, no one saying a word. I thought, I'm a superstar. I'll go out there. What's he doing? I walked out with him to the front veranda. My father sat down on the front veranda, faced the east. The sun was shining, and Barry sat beside him. And my father said, how are you, Barry? I'm not very well, Jack. How are you? No, life's difficult. I remember exactly the conversation. Then my father said to him, Barry, I forgive you. You look after your family. And they walked to the car. His wife got out in my small country town, in Opie. She got out, she was crying, she hugged my father, he was crying. As we walked back in, I said, Dad, what are you doing? He said, Don is not coming back with John. If I don't forgive him, I will not be able to be a good father for you or a husband for you. Forgiveness will allow us to move on. We won't be healthy. Said the only remedy for the inevitability of history is forgiveness. Otherwise, we remain trapped in a predicament of irreversibility. Now, it's tough. It's not easy. I've run retreats on forgiveness. We've had to look at it really closely. We've had to look at all the studies that have been done in that area, and I haven't got it here tonight, and I apologise. But if you want to check out why forgiveness is so important, just tap in forgiveness and the Mayo Clinic, and it'll tell you why forgiveness is unbelievably critical to you, your health, and not only your health, but the health and well-being of all those in your relationship matrix. This is a really fundamental state. So integrity. First, do no harm. And the golden rule, treat others as you would want to be treated. The next and fourth element of a quality relationship is hope. And that's what we receive as Christians. And that's what's described for us beautifully in the New Testament. Imagine, you look at all the studies that have been done on hope. Hope is the belief that the future can be better than the present. Hope is the promise to actively give, to contribute, to care for each other, and to strengthen the relationships. When hope is created in a relationship, it builds an expectation that mistakes and at times of trouble can be overcome. Now, King Cameron, the wonderful professor in Michigan, he didn't have hope. He had optimism. And I wasn't happy with optimism, and I couldn't work out why. And I was invited, as an Anglican, I was invited to a Jewish dinner in Melbourne, where they had invited Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was the leading Jewish rabbi in the Commonwealth. A beautiful man. If you want to find anything about forgiveness, just tap in Jonathan Sacks and forgiveness. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and forgiveness. And you can look at a 3-minute video or a 50-minute video talking about forgiveness. He taught philosophy at Cambridge, and he's now deceased. Very sad that he's no longer with us. I was invited to have a 20-minute private conversation with him, and then it was extended to 40 minutes because some other person was going to have 20 minutes, was ill. And I was asked, would I like 40 minutes? Yes, I would like 40 minutes. We went in and we were discussing what I'm talking to you about tonight. and I said, I'm worried about optimism. He said, no, you should be joining. Optimism is static, hope is dynamic. So you know that if you're hopeful, you do better than if you have less hope. These are really critical, fundamental things that are essential on how we manage life. Christ was hopeful. The disciples were hopeful. Have a look at St. Paul. One of my great friends wrote a PhD, St. Paul, the Educator for the Millennium, and converted to a book and came and gave it to me because he likes the work that I'm doing in reference to forgiveness in schools. Paul went around, and you read the epistles and so forth, Paul went around and he gave hope. These things are critical to us, and we need to look closely at them. So hope. And the last one is compassion. Right? Compassion is the understanding that we all make mistakes. Compassion is accepting this in ourselves and in other people with whom we are in a relationship. Everyone will make a mistake. Well, I don't, but Jen does. These are important. Everyone makes a mistake. How we deal with that is really, really important. Compassion is the gift of care to others and to ourselves. It is also the intention to create good rather than harm the world. This is really important stuff. Now let me just tell you that a narcissist is a person that thinks that they are the greatest thing in the world and that no one else really matters that much. It's all about them. And you will see that I think I put it, yes, the hashtag we first, the hashtag me first world. Hashtag me first world is just self-centered. They don't believe in rehabilitation or redemption and so on. Look at, think about this. A narcissist finds it very, very difficult to think of other people. But they are empathic. They are empathic. How do we know they're empathic? We all have mirror neurons. You know, when I'm looking around here, you know whether you're looking at someone, you know whether they are anxious, sad, or angry. You know that's the case. Why? Because mirror neurons, you pick it up, you can read the emotional state of another. If you are compassionate, and if I look at John and he's looking sad, and I'm compassionate, I would pick up that he's sad and I would say, are you okay? That's where are you okay comes from. Are you okay? And then I, by doing so, I care, I show care. Whereas if I'm a narcissist, I look at the price, his business, not mine. So this is the really important thing. So the five elements are trust, forgiveness, integrity, hope, and compassion. Absolutely critical to you understanding what the Christian faith is about. It's about care. It's about what Bishop Tutu wrote about. It's about giving yourself a break, forgiving yourself when we get wrong. To err is to be human. These are critical things. So I wanted to make certain that every person I dealt with, whether they were colleagues, whether they were students I was teaching, whether they were athletes I was coaching, whether they were my neighbour, whether they were, and by the way, everyone on the road, everyone in here, everyone next door are your neighbours by law. The law of tort. You have no right to harm them. We've had some terrible accidents with trucks driving into schools and things along those lines. we have to protect. You can't walk down a footpath and just shed prints on it. We have rules of conduct. All these are built around. We live in a Christian society where we need to care for others. This was when I've run retreats on forgiveness, and I've done it in major schools from Xavier and so forth, and with religious faith. If we look at the Old Testament, it was a pretty rough world. There were lots of destruction. So if I said to you at this stage, just look at the Old Testament, what's going on in the Middle East, and say, this is terrible stuff. How do we deal with it? I want you to be God just for a moment. I know some probably at times you think you are, but I want you to think, how are you going to deal with this? How can we stop this? So I set this as a work unit. Come up with something that might be worthwhile. How can we actually change our culture? So I was employed at Geelong Grammar School to change the culture of the school. It was a punitive culture. It was what was normal in school. You misbehave, out! Put your hand out. Up until 1987, and I've been teaching there not quite 20 years, up until 1987, I could have literally, physically harmed anyone who misbehaved in my class or in the school. I was licensed to do it. Corporal punishment was possible. What? I had no right to do that. Hang on a minute, I was an adult. No, just kids. All of a sudden, you couldn't do it anymore. So what are we going to do about it? So we, instead of physical punishment, was excluded. So we had to change that. So I had to go to a military institution, the schools were, and change it all. So it took some time because no one wanted to change. Certainly the teachers didn't want to change. Parents were not that concerned about it being changed. Oh, I got it wrong. Just clip behind the ears, give me some detention, whatever it might be. Can't do that. It's immoral to do that. So you rewrite all the policies on the basis of kindness and forgiveness. And then had to get everyone to live. So I encourage you, please, to look carefully at the way you manage the mistakes you make that impact you and those near and dear to you. Can you manage them constructively, kindly, through forgiveness? People who make mistakes that impact you, can you carefully give them a break? As well. Do what my father did. Make it possible for them to get up with dignity. These are, and I had to change the entire way we dealt with problems. And that's why I've given you the relationship-based thing, and it's on the table, and some of you can take it away. And if you don't want to take it away, then don't. Just leave it there so I might. But if you take it away and it doesn't make sense, you can make it back away. I don't mind. And there's an overarching, this is relationship reparation. And I want to read this to you because I want to make certain that you understand where I'm coming from. So relationship-based education, this is relationship reparation. When they make a mistake and you're in a relationship, please understand that you have to work with people, not doing things to them. You must empower them, not have power over them. Power with rather than power over. These are critical, philosophical, and religious, and certainly Christian underpinnings. So, relationship of reparation, or RR, and you've got it here, integrates knowledge about the neurobiological, psychological, and social consequences of trauma into procedures and practice that guide a safe, compassionate, respectful, and quality relational therapy environment. We're rebuilding. We're making it possible for us to all live with dignity and to live together, not apart. This is really important. Most importantly, relationship reparation recognises that punishment or adversarial interventions, especially those mandated, can be disempowering and oppressive. This can add to the trauma and harm associated with relational dislocation. Now, when relationships break up, it's a difficult time. We do not teach children or adults how to form quality relationships. Now, on what basis should you form a relationship? Can I go back to the cross and say, this was the request? Please form a relationship on the basis of contribution, of enabling. Don't form a relationship on what you can get out of it. Don't be transactional. Add value, don't take value from a relationship. A person who forms a transactional relationship, what they do is that they're seeking benefit from it. Now, we will get benefit from any relationship we form. But if we form it on the basis of just seeking benefit, as soon as the benefit is diminished, we're out of the relationship. Damn it, why should I stay? Now, none of you here who have children or grandchildren want any of your children or grandchildren to be known as takers in a relationship rather than givers. Takers end up being alone. They are terrible team members. They will not work with you, they'll work against you. They do not collaborate. They will not cooperate. It's all about them. The only reason they form the relationship is to get their own benefit. It's unbelievably transactional. You know them. In the end, you don't want them in your team. Now, I've worked with them. The only way I can change them from being takers to givers is to be kind and to actually live that kindness with them. And in the end, they understand. And that's what those 3 years that Christ had did. He took people who had formed transactional relationships and made them into disciples. These are really interesting things if you look at them really closely. So it's tailored to attend to the needs of all stakeholders within the context. All partners, all relationship members. It is not intended to coddle offenders. We all make mistakes. Excuse misbehaviour or condone victimisation. It is a way of conceptualising and responding to problematic behaviour through the actual relationship lens, care. It delivers a psycho-educational focus which is helpful to all stakeholders. Sit up straight. I don't want that again. How many? It's unhelpful and it creates trauma. You don't know what creates trauma for various people. You don't have to go to war to suffer from PTSD. These are really interesting things, and the body keeps score, a wonderful book written by Bessent van der Kolk, looking at trauma. is a really important thing. Right, so neurobiologically, psychologically, social and cognitive development is impaired by trauma. You have no one put the hand up about having a license to harm. So this is why I really look closely at how can we repair. Relationship reparation also recognises the positive health impact of relationship repair. Go to the Mayo Clinic and look at it. The education outcomes enable all to recognise the interpersonal neurobiological responsibilities and obligations possessed for relationship. I have three daughters, six grandchildren. I love them dearly. It doesn't mean that we don't have different thoughts, different ideas. I respect them. I listen carefully, actively listen. I don't jump in too early. I try not to be judgmental. I try to have an open heart as well as an open mind. I'm prejudiced. I'm not at all. We have discrimination. This morning I was working with multi-faith, multi-cultural people who were endeavouring to introduce into state schools and faith-based schools a whole concept of multi-faith so that we understand not only what we believe as Christians, but what Muslims believe. That we respect attempt not to be intolerant. These are really important things, and the studies that have been done on it, this is fundamental to us getting rid of racial discrimination, getting rid of colour, sexuality, gender, all the discriminations that we are challenged with moment to moment. So it recognises the positive health impacts. The interpersonal neurobiological responsibilities and obligations we have. You've been marvellous. You've been unbelievably kind to me tonight. You've listened. These are really important things. You know when you're talking to someone and you look them in the eye, you know whether this person's listening or not. You know that. You know whether they've turned up or not. And if you're like me, talking to someone and you know they're not listening, it's a little bit off-putting. I could use a different term. It's something put me off. Right? It upsets me just a little. Right? I trusted every person I ever coached, every person that I ever taught, and I trust all you people. That knowing full well that there is. And we had to quieten the white noise, so thank you for stopping the white noise.
No problems.
But it's very difficult to stop and quieten the grey noise. What do I mean by grey noise? What you're thinking about. That's why meditation is important. That's why prayer is important. No good praying and thinking about what am I going to do after. Must pay attention. I had open heart surgery. I had to have a valve replaced, a big valve replaced in my heart. Because we're relationships are really important. I've been monitored as a hereditary problem. My brother had a mitral valve replaced. I had to have the other valve replaced. And after being monitored for 10 years, and going home after every time I saw the cardiologist, Jen would say, Challen said, it's okay, we'll let it go for another year. You're pretty healthy, you're doing well. And I went in January to see him, and he said, look, you're 75, you're pretty healthy, mate. Can you stop what you're doing just for a couple of months? With schools and businesses, can you just stop that for a couple of months? Because I think we'll do it. We'll replace the valve. Right. OK. connect, what does that mean? Well, we're going to stop you. We're going to stop you from breathing. We're going to stop the heart. We've got to open it up, cut it up, put another valve in, sew you back up, put you back together again. Okay, I went home after 10 years, went in, and Jen said, so what did Challen say? I said, it's going to happen next week.
What?
Well, everyone said, well, so I was sent off to a surgeon. So, and this is in Geelong, so I went to the Geelong Heart Centre, and I, at 8:30 in the morning, mask time, and I'm sitting there quietly, and I'm filling out a form. The reception was lovely and said, good morning, John, give my details and so forth. And I'm signing a form which said that if I died, it wasn't his fault. Right? So I signed the form, and in came, and I was the only one in the waiting room, in came this fellow with the mask on, said good morning to the receptionist and went down to his rooms. And I thought, oh, probably the surgeon. So I'm signing the form. And you know when someone comes and stands beside you and you have a look and you can feel them. And he said, how are you, Hendo? And he was a boy that I taught in 1993, was the surgeon. Relationships matter. We had a long conversation with many people in the waiting room when I came out. We laughed and joked. I loved him. He knew that at that time. He was a Malaysian boy. He's an associate professor now, operates all over the world. Really started that. I hadn't seen him for more than 30 years. But when he came across, he faced difficult times at school. People will understand, I actually helped him. He's never forgotten. On the 29th of March this year, he took me out to lunch out in Geelong. It wasn't an expensive lunch. He said, rang me and said, Hendo, are you coming into Geelong? And I said, no, and I wasn't really. He said, what about coming in tomorrow? I'll take you to lunch. And I said, are you paying? Yep, I'll come. So I went in. And we're sitting there, and we're just having Malaysian food, of course, it's Malaysian. But we're sitting there having the food, and I looked at it, and he said, would you like a glass of wine? Love it. And I'd have a Chardonnay if I had to. Go. So I had a glass of Chardonnay, and I said, listen, Jim, what's all this about? He said, 2 years today, I operated. Relationships really matter. They don't go away. That came to me very quickly when I was singing in a choir as a 6 and 7 year old, 8, 9, 10. I sang in an Anglican choir for over 20 years. I sang in a competition. This is important. So when Peter asked me to come, I thought, when I was living in Echuca, the Anglican Church was here, and the mix were across the road on the night. And I've delivered eulogies in St. Pat's to great friends of mine. Very sad. Gotcha. Our adversarial system is not built on trust in another. We need to look beyond that. And that was asked for the cross. So very, very important. I'm very fortunate. We live in a country where, in fact, these things are possible. We have to look beyond the reactive circumstance, but also put on your table here, the dig for and for dig. This is Vietnamese Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. He teaches walking meditation. So I want to stop in a moment. I'm going to, I'm going to give you a 1 minute meditation. This is a long, 1 minute's a long time. Right, 1 minute meditation. And I want you to do your best here. So then I'll close the board down. So if you could just sit up straight, put your feet up and back on. Yeah. At the moment there's a lot of brain noise going on and so forth. The owner and your five senses are active. They are never not active. Right? So the only sense that I can probably have some control over is sight. So if you could, and if you feel comfortable, if you could just close your eyes. Could you just take one or two breaths, please? You don't have to worry about will you continue breathing, you breathe. Any thought that comes into your mind, could you just acknowledge that thought, please, and then just let it go. Bring your attention, your focus back to just feeling the breath of the diaphragm as it expands and contracts. So any thought, just acknowledge it, let it go, just to feel the breath as it expands and contracts. Do it for a minute, study. Our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Thank you very, very much for being here.
Thank you, John. Just in reflection, if I could sum it up with what I took away from it, was Barry, I forgive you, that really touched me and sort of set the scene for the talk. How your father was able to do that, and you got a lot from that. Yeah, such great information and insight about the dignity of the human person. And just adding value to a relationship, giving and forgiving and living in kindness with each other. So thank you so much. We'll open up, I guess, to questions.
Any questions?
Yeah. And maybe while the questions are going, if I could ask a couple of the brothers, so the God and Beer is a free event. If anyone would like to donate to the event so we can keep these going, I've got a couple of guys who will go around and teach
questions. John, after your brother died, did you continue with your sporting blood?
When my brother died, my twin brother had left Echuca and gone to Bendigo to the School of Mines to study engineering. I was finishing off, it was April, and I was to go to University High School, Carlton were doing all that. I was to go to University High School. I went back to school I wrote to Carlton and said I could not do that. And as the hearse went round and out to the Echuca Cemetery, all the school lined up on one side of the road and all the Carlton footballers lined up on the other side. So it convinced me, and I said to the principal of the school, I can't leave because my parents had three children, they would have had enough at home. So the principal was a wonderful fellow. We went for a walk down to the Murray River and back. And he said, I understand. So I continued to play cricket at that level, but I didn't go on with any football.
So stopped the sporting career, basically?
I gave football away. I did play a little bit of football and that, but no, not at all. It was interesting. I was asked to speak at that principal's 100th birthday. A long time later, I can tell it was a long time later, and he responded, and he actually described the conversation we had about saying I couldn't leave, and you do some it's challenging. I had to actually say to my parents after about 8 months, we can't go to the cemetery. Challenging times. Life's impact. John.
If you want to forgive someone and you're having a bit friction and they put you in a bad environment, you forgive them just to go back in that bad environment?
Forgiveness primarily is for yourself. The easiest way to describe that is beautifully in a book, I Shall Not Hate, by Zeldin, surname, where he lived in the Gaza Strip and they robbed his family and his family.
So it's best if you separate,
yeah.
At least for a time, moving to the future, who knows what comes.
Yep, he doesn't know what comes. Yeah. So, what forgiveness does is, Hannah Rent said, it releases you from being controlled by that. And that's what came from the cross. So it is a matter of, and you. So primarily forgiveness is for you, but you also, by doing that, you also you add value to yourself in how you deal with the perpetrator.
Like I said, I hold no grudges, I hold no bitterness, everything's fine with me. But if I go back to my environment, it might be toxic again. So I need to leave it as it is. They go their way, I don't mind. And it will happen.
Yeah. So I've written a whole series of things, the way forward. The only, when you get up off the box, that's where you need to do the change. Another job.
John, I'm curious, what do you think enabled your father and also Barry to do what they did in that moment? I feel like that's a 1 in 1,000 person who would have that wisdom and that kind of, grace to react the way your father did. Yeah, do you have any idea what enabled him to do it?
He believed in God.
It was real deep faith.
A deep faith and a belief. The wonder of my father was that he always looked for good. He always looked for the positive side. I'll give you an example about when I was first selected to play for the Carlton First 11, we were playing, and I was 15. And Carlton were playing at the Brunswick Oval, so playing Fitzroy. And the opening bowler for Fitzroy was then Alan Thompson, Crobby Thompson, who was opening the bowling for Australia at the time. And my father said to me on the Friday night, So we're sitting in the at our kitchen table with his three sons, mum and dad's. He said, "So John, who are you playing for? Who's coming back for?" I said, "Oh, Fitzroy. Who plays for Fitzroy?" Now I reckon he knew, but he asked the question, and I said, "Oh, well, this is not the right." And he said, "Who opens the volley? You're opening the bat, aren't you?" "Bat." And I said, "Yes." "Who opens the volley?" And I said, "Oh, what a concert goes for Australia. I'm playing against him." And he said, "No, you're not John. You're not playing against him. This is a game. You're playing with him. Now he'll do his best, and you'll do your best. And with a bit of luck, he'll do well, and you might make some." And I've never forgotten. Life is about doing your best. And not, my closest friends that I, the lifelong friends since that time, were people who played games in other sides, against the sides I played in. And, you know, it's fascinating to talk to them about just that. I'll finish with one story about how relationships never go away. My last year in Echuca High School, I was the head prefect, head boy prefect. There was a head girl prefect, and her name was Robin Lyle, and Robin went to Melbourne University, what she went to be a physiotherapist at Lincoln Institute, which was in Swanson Street then, no longer exists. And I went to Melbourne University to do commerce and education, and we knew no one. And I'd been in Melbourne for about 6 weeks or something, and there was a telephone call in with Robin, and she said, "Will you do me a favour?" "What's that?" "What's that?" And she said, "There's the physiotherapist ball next Friday. Will you come with me?" "I don't know anyone else." "Oh, all right. I'd like to deal with it." "Yeah, of course I will." So I went. About 4 months later was the commerce ball. Well, she opened on the phone, rang her and said, "Hey, you owe me one. You've got to come to the..." "Yeah, I'll do that." So we did that. She was staying in Edith Head Hall in Flinders Street, doesn't exist anymore. So took her back there, thanked her very much. That was that. Then we were both invited to a meal with a fellow I played cricket with, and he was engaged to a girl who was doing physio with Robin. So we went for a meal at their place, and that was the last time I saw her. I was invited to, my wife was in Western Australia, her sister had a stroke and she was over there helping, and I had a telephone call from the fellow, the lifelong friend that I played cricket with, and he said, "Come on, you silly old kid, come down here, you're batching, you're probably starving, come down and we'll cook you up a meal." So I went there, and his wife had done physio with Robin. So we're having a meal, and I thought, "Oh, right, Judy, do you ever hear from Robin? How do you know Robin?" And I said, she said, "Perfectly." "Oh, right. Oh, no. Oh, I saw her 4 years ago at our 50-year reunion, but no." And then while we're having a meal, I saw her on the phone, and then at the end of the meal, she said to me, "There's her email address," and she got it off somewhere else. So I just wrote it in my diary, and home I went. A fortnight later, I was just going through, checking up whether I'd covered everything, and there's, "Oh, right." So I sent an email. "Hi, Robin. I hope life's been kind to you. It's been a long time. Love to meet up for a cup of coffee. Where do you live?" Immediately came back, "What a surprise. Love to have a cup of coffee. Right? But at the moment, it's not a good time." And the reason it wasn't was her husband was dying from cancer. And she lived in Yakandanda anyway. It's a long way away. Right. So, about a month later, she let me know that her husband had died. She sold up there and moved back to Melbourne, and it would have been probably 8 months later, I had a telephone call. Hi, John, are you in Melbourne at all? And I said, I am. And she said, I'm staying with some friends in Brunswick. Love to have that coffee. So we met at, at Brunetti's. And I was sitting there, I got there early, and I had books and I'm forever going through and analysing things and such. So I was doing that, and we're going to have it at 9:30, coffee. And I looked, and it was 25 to 10. I remembered, she's never late. I look up, and there's this woman standing at the door, looking around, and I got it, and I went like that, and pop, and she came over, gave her a hug, and she said, your hair's changed. So is yours. Relationship never, ever go away. And she's come down and stayed with us. It's been wonderful. So I just encourage you, think about the quality of relationships. Think about the dignity and the purpose of your life. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. It's really, really wonderful. Any other questions? I'll run for cover.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I've got to say something. So, I first met at Geelong Grammar School when my foster son was there as a boarder. And many of you know about my foster son. He came from a very traumatised past. So his first 10 years of life was pretty bad. He turned out to be a great guy. He's still living with me. But my relationship and friendship with John has grown from there, because John was head of wellbeing at the time and was involved in helping Jared, my foster son, with his struggles in moving through the school. He got through and he succeeded, not all that well, but passed Year 12 and so on, and went on and did a diploma in youth work. He's working in a factory now, so who knows where he's going. But it's been a very rich relationship, and because John has influenced me in my counselling business, dealing with relationship counselling.
Right.
I use what John's been talking about tonight in all my relationship counselling, and it's just amazing the impact that it can have if we take on board what John's been sharing tonight and live it. And it's based on our Christian values. We can't go far wrong. So, thanks very much, John. Great.
Thank you all. Good
job.
Thank you.
John, just before we close, we'll have a gift for you. Thank you for your time, and I'm sure everyone, as I just did, was very...
Yeah,
that's it.
Thank you.
Half of the night. So.
Thank you.